Thank you. We will move into the strategic planning portion, and I'd start by inviting Mr. Peterson to come forward. He has been... He's here. And we have the other speakers that are scheduled for today. This is moving forward through the strategic planning. As I'll ask everybody that's moving out to try and be as quickly and quietly as possible so we can go ahead and get started. Yeah, thank you. Neil?
He's over there.
Oh, where did he disappear to? he's in the back there. Okay.
There you go. There he is.
Okay.
And both of the presenters are back there as well.
I see Mr. McLean. I don't see Alan.
White shirt. Yeah. Alan is our speaker.
Yeah, but I thought I saw him before. Thank you.
So you're just keeping your ears open? Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Are you? Good to see you. Oh, there's Mr. Pisarcy. He's very good piece. For the people who are moving around, if you could just move outside of the room and continue your conversation, because we do want to get started right away. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. We're glad to see you back. And continuing the conversation, welcome to Mr. McLean and Mr. Pisarcy. And you, I'm going to turn this over to you. I think you'll need the mic, please, for recording.
There's a lot of background noise.
Got it.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all. We're lucky today to have two of the leaders, not only regionally but in the nation, to talk to us about what trends are occurring to better inform us on these issues that we're dealing with in the strategic plan, where we want to go and what role we want to play in that. And so what we're going to do is hear two presentations and then open it up for discussion. Does that sound okay? We have two guests. The first to speak is Alan Pisarcy. Those of us that have been in the industry for years, Alan is very well known. He's independent at this point, not affiliated with any institution. Has written extensively, has been honored extensively with... he has advised a whole series of governments, both at the state, local, national level. He's presented to several committees in both the House and the Senate. He's been on every TV talk show you can imagine. He's one of the gurus in the industry, I think it's fair to say, and has received a numerous awards. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Alan Pisarcy.
It's a pleasure for me to be here with you. I'll add to my resume a couple of thoughts. I'm highly qualified to speak because I've lived in Maryland, the District, and Virginia. I came to Washington a long time ago to do the travel surveys for WashCog. I was chief of data collection, and I worked with John at that time. We were both teenagers, of course. how do I make that thing go? Is somebody else going to do that? Oh, there's a gentleman behind me. I'm going to pass through the first part of this, where we're at, rather quickly, just to catch us up on some of the things that are going on, and then move into the more important things about where I think we're going in the future. My slide talks about commuting and transportation, and where, thank you. The main point of this slide, the list of eight activities over there are the things that I use to describe metropolitan or even state transportation. The key point here is simply to note that commuting is a small and, in fact, declining share of what's going on out there. At the most, maybe 20% of just the first two items. If you throw in everything else, it shrinks. But it's still very important because of the reasons that I mentioned there. They're anchors, both home and work, are anchors of other activities, and, of course, the major source of people's frustrations. Just a note on where we are with respect to travel time. On the left, you see the long-term trend, and this is national. On the right, you see the current decade, and the answer is we're not doing much. Things aren't changing. I'm working on Commuting in America 4, and I have a real problem saying anything that's interesting to the press because things are kind of dull. In fact, I was on the a number of years ago was on the Today Show, and they asked me, what do we need to do about congestion? How do we solve it? And I said, 10% unemployment ought to do it. I didn't intend that as a forecast, you understand, it was just an observation. But you can see that since 2000, we've been effectively stable. With respect to mode share, the next one, please. With respect to mode share, again, we're really quite stable. It may look like there's some variation. If you put drive alone and carpooling together, you see that what's going on is drivers are shifting back and forth, and basically you've got 86-87%. And it's just a question of how many cars there are, not how many people are in the auto mode. Transit has been constant at about 5% of the national pattern. Walking continues to decline. Working at home continues to grow. This is something that I tend to look at because I think that carpoolers and transit riders tend to look a lot alike. Public policy sometimes will pull people out of transit into carpooling, or they'll pull people out of carpooling into transit. So as my measure of merit, I use 20% of the sum of carpooling plus transit should be where you're at, hopefully. And the fact is we only have five metros in the country that meet that. Of course, New York, Washington, and San Francisco at roughly 25% each, Chicago Boston are just about at 20, and Philadelphia just a tad behind. So it's a tough test. Basically, carpooling is the dominant factor in the South and in the West. Transit use is the dominant factor in the Northeast in general. Please, next. I used the term 5% before for transit share. That comes out of the consensus definition where they ask people, how do you usually get to work? How did you usually get to work last week? And you get a 5% answer. The National Household Travel Survey conducted by USDOT gets basically the same answer. But if you ask people the question the way we do in urban transportation studies, what did you do yesterday? Then you get an answer that's closer to about 3.7%. In effect, two-thirds of the people who say they usually use transit on any given day are using it, and the other third of the time they're driving alone, carpooling, walking, or doing something different.
Just if you turn that around, you also say far more than 5% use transit at some point during their work week or work month.
If you're talking about the other parts of it, yes, if it's a segment to the, one of the things that happens is that the census says ask you for the majority of your time. So if you used a transit trip and then had a car trip that's longer, you'd be coded as a car trip. That would be. Absolutely. And in fact, I guess what I should show here, or somebody should look at, is this matrix. Because if you look at people who drive alone, Y percent of them on a given day are going to be on transit. Carpoolers are going to be on transit. Walkers and bikers are going to be on transit. And I think it's an important thing to react to rather than simply this kind of usually does kind of thing. The next slide just talks about the fact that we've lost 1.2% of the workforce in the last year, and driving alone declined at about half that in terms of its holding share. Transit declined almost double that. Biking, walking, and carpooling declined almost three or four times that. I don't know quite what's going on with carpool. We could talk about it if you're interested. This is a tough one. May I go up to the screen? I think it's easier to deal with. I apologize for the detail down here, but it's really hard to tell. This is the dominant pattern of the summer of the Okay, where are we going? To me, the critical thing is the search for skilled workers. Next slide, please. Again, basically, things aren't changing much. We've got saturation in driver's licenses, effectively, saturation of car ownership, almost. Low population growth, low household growth, low domestic migration trends, and most importantly, underlined here, low labor force growth. And I think that's one of the critical questions for the future. I know right now we've got 9.2% unemployment, but the fact is this is going to be a critical question for the future. Given all the stability, I guess my argument is that the kind of the old watch-out school of planning that we used at WSCOG, you know, a million more people coming, 800,000 more cars, that isn't the issue today. The issue is we need something of a new context. Solving today's problems, I think, can be a stronger focus than saying how many people are going to be here in 20 or 30 years. Getting the economy out of the mud, I think, will be perhaps the key question. Next, please. In my congressional testimony, I've talked about three trends which I feel will define the future. The first of these is the replacing the baby boomers. Where will the workforce come from? Where particularly will the skilled workforce come from? Talking about expanding metro areas, the areas getting broader and broader and wider and wider, with most of the focus in and on the suburbs. And this sounds contradictory today, but my sense is that we're talking about an affluent, time-focused society in the future, and I propose these as kind of models that say, designed for a system in which the average person is earning $50 an hour and the average value of goods is three times the current value, and tell me what kind of a transportation system you need to serve that society. And that serving that kind of society helps to make that society happen. Talking about the value of time thing, in the early interstate era, folks talked about cost. The value of time grew in the 80s and 90s. In this most recent decade, of course, we began to think about cost more when we got to $4 a gallon gasoline. But I feel for the longer term, the value of time will be the ultimate factor. What's next? This is what's happening to workers added per decade. I've been tracking this since the start of the Commuting in America series. And we peaked out in the 80-90 and declining since. I'm not even sure about that orange bar. The census says we added 8 million. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has a much lower number. So I think we have to be very cautious about that. I know it sounds perhaps absurd, but we may be talking about too few commuters rather than too many. This is the issue on growth. Most of the pop growth changes in the older groups, the 65-year-old group. The working age population is growing at half the rate of the rest of the population. We added more people in this decade than we will in the next two decades in terms of people of working age. And I think that's going to be a critical question. Where then, next slide, please, where are the people going to come from? Are we going to keep older workers at work with the house prices, et cetera? We may be having achieved that already. More women at work, even more women, more immigrants, multitasking, multiple jobs, more variable work schedules to respond to the need for specialization, skills, and productivity in order to be competitive in the world market. This is just to note that, in fact, we're already seeing that we're up to 15% of those over 65 are now working. Compared to about, I think it was 10-11% back in 1990, and that's been growing continuously, and I think we'll see it continue to grow. I won't go into this, but just to emphasize a couple of the areas and where I think we're really weak in some of these access to workers tests, the center city access to suburban jobs, rural access to suburban jobs, I think are some of the key issues, and then, of course, how you deal with the older retirees in their second jobs. And I think recognizing more time-efficient long-distance travel will be central to the region's health.
Excuse me, Tom. Can I ask a question? Alan, you just switched from national to metro, our metro area on this slide?
Yeah, this is basically let me say, I would say this is a national issue, but I also would say this area flunks.
Our Washington
Metropolitan. Yes, this is the Washington Metropolitan.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry. The next slide, it also talks about national plus local metro. This is one of the things that I keep track of, which is the number of people leaving their home county to work. It was back around 24% for the U.S. In 90, it's up to 27%. We lead the nation. It's nice to be first in something in the numbers of people leaving their home counties to work. Virginia, 51%. Maryland, right behind it, at 47%. We can debate what that's all about. You can take your pick on those issues, but I think it's a reality. It's something that we have to recognize. We want to talk a little bit about why we're different, why we're the same. The case for different, we don't have any factories to speak of. We ship a lot of paper. That's about it. We have all these white marble buildings, and they're not leaving. They're not moving to the suburbs. They're staying right where they are. That means the lower-income federal employees are forced to the region's edges for housing in order to commute back. We have high immigrant education levels, much higher than the rest of the country. The number here, 1.89, is the ratio of immigrant college graduates to immigrants without a high school education. And in the country at large, it's about one, roughly one. 1.05. But here in Washington, it's 1.9. We've got twice as many college graduate immigrants as people without high school educations. The next number is highly variable. You can get people to say 6 of 10 richest counties, 7 of 10. Anyway, we are a very rich metropolitan area. And I think in all of those regards, therefore, transit does far better than one would expect, given those factors. Okay, what's the case for no difference? Stable growth like the rest of the country. Basically, we're growing at 1%, which is the same as the rest of the country. Suburbanization continues of jobs, workers, population. I think that's embedded in the COG plan that you've looked at. Substantial immigrant inflows like the rest of the country. Substantial skills mismatches and a very strong suburb-to-suburb structure. I'm sure there are a couple of folks here who will want to argue with me on this one, but basically I'm asking the question, what will the future commuting world look like? I'd be happy to discuss any of these. I won't go into them here in the interest of time. But yes, more job specialization, more affluence, lower density, higher auto affordability, shifts to auto prone age groups, auto trip purposes, et cetera, higher freight value. When I testified in the House on a vision, they said, after I finished, how are you going to fund that vision? And I testified in the Senate on the role of the federal government, and the first question was, how are you going to fund that? You know, so the point is, Washington is so totally focused on where does the money come from. To me, that has an antecedent, and it has to be, please, next. A plan, tell people what you're going to give them for the money. You give me this money and I will produce this. That comes from having some sense of vision, and that vision has to come from a credible source. It has to be basically credibility, I think, is the critical question. I've made this point. This is, to me, the basis for credibility, and here part of this is my general view. Part of this is related to the present situation here at Metro. Transparency, letting people know what you're doing and why you're doing it. Productivity, enhancing the productivity of the system. Greater fiscal responsibility, providing a system that basically works. Having appropriate modesty about expansion when you have immense needs to maintain the system. And fundamentally recognizing consumer sovereignty. This is my goal that I use in many of my talks. My goal for transportation is to reduce the effects of distance as an inhibiting force in our society's ability to realize its economic and social aspirations. Talking to a friend, he gave me this goal, and I find it very, very valuable, and I decided I couldn't say it any better, so I decided to quote him. He said, talking about WMATA, create a culture of duty to the riders, taxpayers, and residents, founded on safety, honesty, transparency, quality, and value for the taxpayer dollar. I think that's a really great statement. Thank you much.
So I think we'll go through the two presentations and open up for questions. Obviously, this is supposed to be stimulating. That was raised a lot of stimulating potential questions. Now we've got Professor John McLean with us, local, currently Deputy Director of the Center for Regional Analysis at George Mason, has served in the region for over 25 years, 15 of which he was with the Council of Governments and directed their planning and policy programs. He also served with the Greater Washington Board of Trade, helped establish and direct the Potomac Conference, created the, quote, State of Potomac presentation, which and other economic research and analytical materials regarding the size of our region's economy. And then he's also worked in the private sector for a commercial real estate company, received his bachelor's Duke, master's regional planning from the University of North Carolina, and is one of our own. And I think Mary specifically suggested that John come and speak to us. John McLean.
Thank you. I would also add that the way Alan qualified himself as speaking here, I can't quite say that I've lived in all three jurisdictions. I lived in Virginia a long time. I've also lived in the district, but I play my golf in Maryland with Mike Barnes. I'm going to sort of my theme here really is looking at growth trends in the region, and I think what I would sort of leave with you at the beginning, I'll say at the beginning, is that Metro in the last 30 years has had a major impact on shaping the pattern of growth in this region. And I guess the question I think would pose to the board is it can in the next 30 years as well, and should it. We are the fourth largest economy. The chart that Alan showed where we were the fifth with the most workers, our workers make more money, so our economy is slightly larger than Dallas. We flip ahead of Dallas on this chart, next chart. And over the last 4 years, our gross regional product has outpaced everybody else's. We have had the most growth. And the reason for that is one that I'm sure you all know, which is the federal government and its presence. For a long time, it was federal employees, but over the last 30 years, it's been federal procurement and purchase from area companies. And what this slide says is, if you look at the each decade here, if you look at the 80s when Reagan came in and started a lot of defense buildup, $84 billion to area companies. In the 90s, it was $191 billion to area companies. And in this past decade, it was $519 billion. It is a major, major part of our economy. And I think one of the questions that we have going forward, is this going to continue? Of course, one of the things this means is that most of those workers are in what we call the professional and business services sector. Those are high-paying jobs. In fact, 700,000 of our 2.9 million workforce is employed in that sector, and they make high incomes. And to back up another point in Alan. Are we going to continue to grow is a question. Go to the next slide. This is our forecast. On an annual basis, we're not immune from recessions. We lost jobs in the 1991 recession, a commercial real estate recession. We lost jobs in this past one, a residential real estate recession. We're currently estimating we'll add about 24,000 jobs overall this year. We won't get back to our long-term average growth until 2013. That pretty much assumes that we're going to continue to get the kind of growth in federal procurement that we have been getting. But that is a question at this point. And we've actually seen in the job data for the last 4 months, this economy's hit a soft spot. We have stopped growing. And that professional and business services sector is the one that's particularly worrisome. And what I think it says to us as we look at the numbers is that some of the big companies are slowing their hiring because they're uncertain about what's going to happen with the political process, the federal budget, the debt ceiling, and all this sort of stuff. So we are in a time here where we're in a soft spot. Experience in the region in our procurement with the federal government in the past, there have always been threats. There's an occasional threat to it. And usually what has happened is that the federal government's decided not to build a particular airplane or a particular tank or whatever. But they've kept the professional business services kinds of functions and headquarters functions that we have in Washington here. So whatever forecast we have that I'm going to show on the next slides, you know, sort of assume that past experience will probably still hold true, but I have to put that caveat on it that we are we are at risk to some extent, our economy is, because of our dependence upon federal procurement. If we look back 11 years, it's kind of an interesting looking at the national picture. This is the largest 15 metro areas. We've added 422,000 jobs. Dallas and Houston are the other two large bars there. We see actually over the last 11 years, L.A., San Francisco, and Chicago, in addition to Detroit, actually all are below the number of jobs that they had in the year 2000. So we have outperformed everyone. Now let's look at the forecast, the growth trends going ahead. This is population. We had almost 3.5 million people in 1980. Today we have almost 2.6, and we're going to grow based on the round 8 forecast of COG to 7.3 by 2040. And looking at the share of jobs by subregion, thinking of this is the old COG convention of CORE being D.C., Arlington, Alexandria, Beltway, meaning Montgomery, Fairfax, Prince George's, and then everything else outside. Jobs, the CORE share, we're not as a centro-dominant region as we were 30 years ago. We have our job base, it's a bigger share of less share of jobs in the CORE. Beltway's been about 40%, 5%, and will continue to do. There's a bigger share increasing in the outer areas, the Loudons and Prince Williams and the Fredericks and Charleses. If we go to households, it's kind of interesting here, particularly in the CORE, from 1980 to 2010, the CORE share of households dropped from 30% to 20%, a huge drop. Population declined over that 30-year period. The forecast is kind of reflecting what we've seen in the last decade, which is that there is a sort of a resurgence of household growth, population growth in areas, and I, you know, transit has something to do with it, but also metro has had something to do with that. Households in the Beltway stays about, the growth is about, the share remains about the same, and again we see the significant growth in share in the outer suburbs. Just looking at the change by subregion in each 30-year period, CORE is still going to add almost as many jobs in the next 30 years as it has added in the past 30 years. The Beltway is going to add a few less, and the outer is going to be more. And then going to households, more households in the CORE, more residential locations, closer into the region, not as many in the Beltway regions, but more in the outer. So that's kind of the numbers. Let me just sort of conclude with a few comments about, you know, what do these trends mean for regional growth and the future? I think that if we look at the last 30 years, clearly the location of rail lines has been a shaper of a lot of our growth, and especially where the metro lines have been overlapped by local land use policy as well as market forces, there has been very strong growth. And we look to models like Bethesda and the Roslyn-Boston corridor. What other things may happen in terms of existing lines, development potential? You know, New York Avenue is kind of a great model. It's held up now by like an infill station. Potomac Yards could be another one. I would say also that in my experience in participation in Arlington with both the Planning Commission 25 years ago and also being on the Clarendon Alliance, as I've watched the growth in the RB corridor, which is, you know, a national model for how you do TOD, I've seen over the decades, you know, we have the bullets in Arlington and we protect the low-density neighborhoods, but gradually over time we're starting to make the density between stations just a little bit higher each time we replan. So we're continuing to infill that growth. We've done a lot of work at George Mason with Fairfax on both the Tyson's Corner replanting effort and the Reston replanting effort relative to the server line coming in. And, you know, the county is really committed to development at both of those places. It's going to be a huge, huge development in that whole corridor. The huge replanting efforts, community activities, staffs, task forces, everybody wants to make the county, have the county capitalize this time. I was a planner in Fairfax when we originally planned to be on a Carter Metro station. So anyway, I think there's a huge potential there. If you look at the forecast to 2040 for that corridor, it's going to add 130,000 jobs. In effect, about one in four jobs, new jobs, that will grow in the Beltway counties of Fairfax, Montgomery, and Prince George's will be in that corridor. So a lot of potential there. Also, you know, there's other opportunities for growth in the, along the Red Line as well. And I think the thing that we would still like to see from a growth pattern standpoint in the region, obviously, is more development in the eastern on the eastern stations, where we have great plans out there, but it hasn't come to Prince George's County as much as I think, and from a regional perspective and a regional economy that we would like. COG uses regional activity centers looking at the future. Not all those regional activity centers are served by transit, are served by rail, obviously. There may be opportunities in the future for doing that, but it may be, everybody can't be, we can't afford heavy rail everywhere. There may be other options. And there are a lot of things being studied, like Montgomery County's 170-mile network of BRT. The jobs housing balance has been a big issue in planning around stations. It was a big issue in the Reston area, and kind of the sort of model in both Tysons and in Reston was to look at the RB corridor, which has essentially a 4-to-1 ratio of jobs and households. So we also have seen, and this next to last point here is the curve bending? Is it a trend, or as Alan's chart said, is it a new trend, or is it the economy stupid that we are seeing some of these things? And I think it's a little bit of both. We've seen more preference for location around metro and closer in the last several years. We've monitored the housing market a lot. We've seen prices in Arlington, Alexandria, Northwest DC, Bethesda, they're roughly at 95% of what they were at the peak. And then we see in Prince William and Prince George's counties, they're 50% of what they were at the peak. So there seems to be a preference. More sensitized commuters are by gasoline. I don't know. You know, we had it years ago. Gasoline went up, and as soon as the gasoline prices went back down, you know, everybody started driving again. But we'll see. Also say, you know, reverse commuting. Is there a potential for getting more capacity and more of this infield growth through reverse commuting? We have it on the highways. I had, for until 6 months ago, had to commute out to the Fairfax campus from my home in Arlington, and I would sit on in bumper-to-bumper traffic on 66. Watching the D.C. license plates, D.C. and Maryland license plates. And so there is reverse commuting, and it's, you know, there's also potentially a partial social goal here, too. Our heavy unemployment is in some of the inner areas of the region. If we had some way of doing reverse commuting with a fair structure, it might make it easier for those people to do that. That may be another thing. So let me just conclude by saying that I think that the building of Metro and the carrying out of constructing and operating a system has been a shaper of the region's growth patterns in the past, and it can be in the future. It may not always be heavy rail. It could be other things as well.
Wow. Food for thought. So let's just open it up for thoughts, questions, comments. Kathy, do you want to start us off?
The comment you talked about the commuting pattern and what, as Metro is looking forward, what did we do in terms of that? Can we do something, I think, is your question. And I pose it in the way of saying if we're not looking at growth, and we would look at where we are today, yes. How do we look at what do we do to improve? What do we look at both in housing and in transportation to provide greater improvement there? We won't be looking at extensions. We may not be talking about improving service outward. But then does it mean that we need to concentrate the improvement of service that exists today to deal with the congestion that exists today rather than the growth of tomorrow?
I guess my answer would be yes to the last point. You know, the focus on where we have problems and to try to improve it. I saw some of the things on the blue and the yellow line, and I think those kinds of responses, the BRT responses perhaps in some cases, would be important to that. I don't see any great short-term or maybe even long-term potential in trying to manipulate the housing markets to get them to work better. I think, you know, the housing situation we're in now, we've got so many people locked in because of mortgage conditions that the odds of people being able to make the kind of shifts that we historically have seen is just way against us. And in fact, around the country, I think this is a really critical question, that we're not seeing people moving to jobs because they can't get out from under a home.
I have a couple of questions. One of them, clearly one of the things that we're going to have to think about in all the planning that we do is population growth. And I know there have been some assumptions in the past about what population growth was going to look like over the sort of the midterm. Perhaps I'm misunderstanding your presentations, but I'm trying to figure out what you are suggesting we might see in terms of population growth. Mr. Pisarski, you had mentioned that you thought low population growth was probably something in the near future. But when I'm looking, Mr. McLean, at your thing, you're projecting a fairly substantial population growth of close to 2 million people between off of a 5.6 million base between 210 and 240. Are those different projections, understanding?
I guess I would suggest that if you do the arithmetic, I think you'll come out to about 1% growth a year. And that's where we are as a country. We're about 0.9, 0.95. So in terms of national trends, I mean, go back when you guys were first building this thing, when I and John were working in Washcott, we were talking about 2.5% annual growth. Where, you know, think of the doubling time of the population. It was 40, 50 years back in the 50s and 60s. It's now 100 years, very close to 100 years. So in those terms, I think, yes, it's big. Yes, it's important to react to it. But we have met the challenges of much higher and more dramatic levels of growth in the past, I guess, is my message.
Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate that. The other question, you had mentioned that looking at more affluence throughout the region in general. I know that on a national level, there's been a lot of discussion of income gaps,
yep.
That you're seeing it. You may be seeing an average going up, but you're also seeing a growth in.
Growth.
Yeah, you're seeing sort of a bimodal distribution or more of a bimodal distribution.
Right.
And the other thing that I think is relevant for us is that because of housing costs going up, we're also seeing some of the less skilled workforce moving out, which also clearly has factors that we need to look at in terms of moving people around. And I'm wondering if you could sort of talk a little bit about that, because I think that
John made the point that we're going to see growth in the exurbs, and a lot
right.
of that is going to be low income stuff. I made the point in my chart of particularly the federal worker who's, you know, the lower grades in the GS scale, but still working downtown and competing for a housing in the middle areas they just can't afford to play. Because people are now living and working in suburbs, they can bid up those suburban housing things, well, markets much, much greater than the historic past. The thing I'd make an important mention of in Washington, there's a great tendency to talk about how that we're a rich area, and we are. But we're a rich area in a funny way. We're not a rich area where there's somebody who's earning $500,000 a year and the family sitting around watching them earn it. The region is dominated by 2 and 3 worker households. And it's the fact that the sum of those 2 and 3 jobs is a high income thing. We have extraordinarily high. You know, think of 2 GS-14s living, or 2 GS-15s living in the same household. So there's a lot of affluence there, but it's because they both are going to jobs, and the question is, which of those jobs are they going to, and where are those jobs located? So I think that's a key concern in this region.
I think you put your finger on one of the things that we really have to deal with, and which is the whole issue of workforce housing. Because if you look at the growth, the forecast that we have for Tysons Corner jobs, those jobs aren't all $125,000 professional services jobs. There's probably a third or fourth of those jobs are the people who work in the hotels and the restaurants and the, and other kinds of jobs.
The offices,
and they have to live, you know, in Culpeper. Or can we, you know, it's one of our challenges. The transit-oriented development has created, you know, housing that is very pricey. And how do we not have to have all of our workers have to live so far out? And Arlington has dealt with it on the RB corridor, and Fairfax is trying to deal with it in their planning for Tysons and Reston both. So, but it's really a big challenge.
Let me add another point that I think is important, because I mentioned in one of the slides, discussed rural population, and I don't think we recognize that enough. As the jobs move out, distances farther and farther from the center of the city, think of Dulles. What happens is that you begin to be able to attract people from West Virginia. You begin to attract people from that part of the country. And so a job that opens up at the Dulles Airport may have a person from West Virginia competing with a person from D.C. for that job. And for a whole lot of reasons. West Virginia had the greatest increase in travel times of any of the states in the last decade. And it wasn't obviously Wheeling. It was people going to Pittsburgh, people going to Washington, people going to Cincinnati. I think that's an important factor to recognize.
The thought about where the jobs are versus where the people are who have the skills that match those jobs seems to me like an opportunity for Metro. If we could understand where that mismatch is, it might give us clues about places where we would want to consider enhancing service so that we look at what some of those, and I don't know, and I guess my question really is it something that you can map in a way that might help us think about where we know we have low-hanging fruit in some places. Like we have people going out into Prince George's in the morning. They get on the train. It's gravy for us. Every new person who gets on the train going out to Prince George's in the morning, because we're running that train, whether there's 5 people, 10 people, or 100 people on the car. But when we think about some of these other things that have less to do with fixed rail and more to do with flexible bus service or other kinds of things, I think having a way to think geographically about what the opportunities are to help the region, is there a way to even do that?
Yeah. Well, you know, mismatch of jobs. I remember the many years ago when I was just at the time I left COG back in the mid-'80s, that we did a study on reverse commuting. And one of the goals of the study was to sort of see if we could identify locations where there were people that were low skilled, and how could they get to jobs that required low skill, like, you know, commuting from Anacostia to Old Town, for example. And there's some possibilities there. It kind of got nothing happened to it really. There was one case that we did. And I don't know if Alan remembers this, because we started bus service from some areas in Anacostia to Seven Corners, and the bus was full when it all started out, and after about 6 months, the buses were half full. And I said, "What's going on?" Well, they were more well-to-do, and they bought cars.
And my reaction to that is that was a very positive thing for Metro to be doing, to be introducing people to the labor force and getting them into the system and providing, a greater job opportunity. I mean, it can be looked at from the ridership is down. That's a bad thing. But, you know, to me, it's a positive.
But I still think that's something that could be looked at. Yeah, I think you're right.
The job. Let me pursue the job worker balance a little bit. I talk a little bit. I talk about a mythical community called Fairfax County, Virginia, in my book about job worker balance. And Fairfax County has this almost perfect job-worker balance, one-to-one, and the skills mix is really quite good. If you look at Arlington next door, which everybody tends to think is so neat, they have a terrible job-worker balance. I'm sorry.
We have lots of jobs and lots of people, but they don't.
They don't have anything to do with each other. So you export more people every day as a percentage, and you import more people every day as a percentage. Maybe you call that a market in fancy terms. But that is, in fact, the reality of it. But if you go back to the point about two people in this, having jobs in the same household, you really can't talk in terms of matching people to jobs. I mean, I did work in Shanghai, and where the government owned the people, owned the jobs, and owned the housing, and they still couldn't get it right. Because, person changed jobs or person married somebody from another factory. And so that is just way, way too difficult to try to push that too far. By the way, let me say that in Arlington, with a large part of the military moving out, the potential there of those Roslyn office buildings to match some of the workforce skills of Arlington, I think would be, if you wanted to make that argument, would be an area where you could talk about significant inroads. Sorry.
Interesting that you raised the job worker piece, say the Fairfax piece, though. But the question asked, though, is while we see many of those folks within working, and we look at the challenges that are there, the congestion that we live through, and I was wondering when you were saying before, what is there available to improve upon? And I think what the improvement opportunity may be the improved services internally, because those are the choices that are going further out. That is, if you're only making so much money and you're spending an hour in traffic because you don't have an alternative, why not just go out and get a cheaper home and now make your hour and 15 minutes the world? And I think we have a huge piece of that in trying to make the quality services that makes the housing costs and transportation costs come together by reducing the cost of the car and making the service as a larger part of the community better. Because to me, that's where those activity centers make a difference. We have tons of housing in Fairfax County. And the question is, how are they served and where are they connecting to those jobs? Many of them are running around within Fairfax County, but they're parking lots all over the county while they do so. So to me, it's not growth only. It's how do we improve upon the overall transit service.
It's the housing transportation index.
That's exactly, yeah.
Thanks very much for your presentation. It's really, really helpful, I think, to help us frame, because we're struggling, obviously, with this strategic planning looking 20, 30 years out. Who should we look at as the models? You said Shanghai is not the model.
I can promise you that.
But who's doing this right? We're not going to be able to build much more heavy rail anytime soon. We were talking about the cost of the one we're doing now this morning, and nobody knows where that money's coming from. So we're looking at bus rapid transit probably is going to be a huge piece of how we deal with these couple million more people that John on your chart are going to move into our region here in the next 30 years. Who's doing this right? What is there a city in the United States, a region in the United States? Is there a region in Europe? Is there somebody that's figured this out and we could look at as a model?
I guess the answer to my first reflex is no. everybody would point at Curitiba in Brazil. Obviously, people in the United States point at Portland. I don't think Portland really is significant to the Washington metropolitan area in many respects. I'd love to think on that and have a great answer for you, but there's no place, I can't say go to Milwaukee, that's where they really got it straight. Let me go back and reiterate something I said before, that Washington is doing far better than it deserves, given all of the factors, really. I mean, transit ridership in Washington and carpool ridership in Washington are national leaders in almost every regard. So in the sense of percent of commuters in single-occupant vehicles, You guys look real good. It's just that those people don't think they're very happy in those vehicles. But, you know, you should just tell them, hey, we're doing great compared to Houston or compared to Chicago. Why don't you love us, you know? But, no, that isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
No, but I made them, I mean, Washington was number one in carpooling.
There's no place in Europe. I mean, when you go to Paris, you have the sense that they've got
everybody,
a great public transit system. I don't know.
You can look at the document. You can see the documentation on the Historical Trends of Paris, and it looks, it's suburbanizing, jobs moving to the suburbs, circumferential commuting. It looks just like Washington. It looks just like Houston. It looks just like Chicago. Vienna, you know, London, take your pick.
From a strategic perspective, I appreciate the presentation, both presentations. The question of responding to the now is certainly very important, but the strategic one is where we really have to focus. And for me, the esoteric side of it is how much of it are we leading in terms of from a transportation standpoint, and how much of it is following. And frankly, our conversation to this point really has been along how do we position ourselves to follow what's happened. And I believe it misses the point that we need to put on the table how much of what we will decide to do will actually shape what happens as opposed to being in the position of following what happens. And the issue that we confront, which, John, you spent your life focused on, is the multi-jurisdictional nature of where we are and being able to coalesce a strategy and a plan when we make our economic decisions independently and we make our transit decisions collaboratively and in part, not fully. But I think that's the challenge of what we're trying to do. And to the extent that we can crystallize the data and the cost of the transit and how it is either impacted by or influences Region Forward, I think that's how we can reshape the dialogue around the development investment. And what's not clearly articulated, and we've talked about this at many of our meetings, what's really not out there as a data point is just what the cost of the transit infrastructure in all of its context will be to service that 2040, that Region Forward environment. And the last point I'd make right at the moment is it would really, I think we need to reshape the dialogue of what transit means to our overall marketplace. You know, we don't discuss whether water is needed for a community. We use water as a lever. And I think we have to put transit in the context, in the same kind of context. It really shouldn't be, can we afford transit? The question is, how do we afford transit? I mean, we have to be in a position where we can clearly articulate what's necessary for the marketplace. And then the dialogue becomes, how do we fund and build what's necessary for the marketplace as opposed to, should we build that for the marketplace? And I don't think we have that dialogue at the right place with the right data, with the right group of people around it, because I think we have to force that dialogue as a transit board. We can't build any of these things by ourselves unless people fund us meaning the transit system. And I think we've got to make sure that our dialogue and our plans get the data out there so that it can be discussed properly. And that's where the political trade-offs and the political discussions between Maryland and D.C. and Virginia and the federal government have to be shaped, because it all grinds to a halt if we can't fund it and if we can't build it.
Thanks. And I think Alvin hit on the nail on the head. Is that right? What I was wanting to say is that I think as a metro board, we do need to figure out how we can be shapers of trends. Obviously, we have to react to what people are making rational decisions, are deciding in our region, but we have to figure out, given our compact and given our relationships with each other, how can we shape what happens? I think we've started that type of discussion in the work that Nat's group is doing,
and saying, listen, we have underutilized stations. How can we attract development to those stations so that we're attracting jobs where the infrastructure exists currently and is underused? I think we need other ideas like that. And I think largely this discussion is focused on what individual jurisdictions' decisions and how they impact the whole region and our transit choices and the transit costs. But how can we use this compact to incentivize individual decisions that will have a more beneficial regional impact? And I think those are the questions, because left on our own, you know, we're each going to try to attract the big employer. You know, we are amping up, let you know, if I could finish, you know, with it, we want to attract them. We're throwing tens of millions of dollars at them. Fairfax might throw, you know, another. And so all of this is attracting employment, but it may not be attracting it in the most efficient way in terms of our own jurisdictional investments, and certainly not in terms of our existing transit infrastructure. So I think what I like to explore is, there a way that we can use the investments that we're making at Metro to incentivize the land use decisions that we are making separately?
I was going to observe that John and I worked at WashCog in the quote-unquote good old days, and one of the things I remember in Maryland was everything was going up the 270 corridor, and they were saying, well, what we really need is an alternative corridor on I-95. We need to promote development on 29 and I-95. And then you find yourself in the situation of trying to promote something for the future's sake, in which over here, a whole bunch of people are yelling very loud, do something. And then you tell them what you're up to, and they say, you're going to go build investments where there is nothing, because you think in the long term that's going to change the problem over here where we've got a big-time problem today. And I think that any jurisdiction anywhere in America subject to public interest and public concern is constantly facing that situation of reacting to the need now vis-a-vis some modeling approach that says, if I put more mobility, more accessibility here, I'm going to change the land use structure, and it'll be a good thing eventually. It's a very hard sell.
I guess my point in that is, we're going to continue. We're not fixing anything unless we kind of change the way we're making those decisions individually. Because when I looked at the trends that you presented, and we see the job numbers going down in the core and the job numbers going up, for me, that is a big problem for my jurisdiction, because those are tax dollars, people who aren't making money in our city and won't have the possibility to live in our city. And all of those jobs and that income and those dollars and taxes are going elsewhere in the region. So for us, we want to make sure that as a member of this compact, that we're investing in decisions that will be beneficial for the whole region.
I really have to say we have a little less than that, because we have a following agenda item that we need to address. And I think the questions to Mr. Pisarski and Mr. McLean have been very good, and maybe we should move on to talk about where we're going to come back to start talking about roles and how we use this data as a goal setting.
I'm sure John and I would be happy to answer any questions that come forward and you want to send it to us. I know a lot of the folks here, they know how to find me.
Yeah. Okay. Is that the consensus?
So what I'm hearing from you is that we want to lay out our plan for the next steps. We don't want to really discuss in depth roles.
No, that's right. Let me say thank you to Mr. McLean and Mr. Pisarski for coming. We really appreciate the information. Thank you. Good seeing you again.
Very stimulating. Thank you so much. So the staff has put together a framework that you've all been sent which is basically, again, designed to stimulate discussion among you about roles. If you recall this summer in our workshops, we talked about roles. And this is another way of presenting it and trying to break the point here without going through the details is that different types of roles, whether it's leader, advocate, or operator, and there might be some others too. I mean, for example, we talked about convener. So this isn't preclude other options here. But then what Nat and his staff and Rich have done is they've said, well, you know, depending upon the area you're talking about, the answer could be different. It's not we're a leader in every area. We might decide to be an operator in additional services provided in outlying areas, for example, or not. So you've got some options here. So if I think as homework, I mean, my suggestion is you go back over this, given the background that we've gotten today, and that we use this as a framework for discussion next time. Now, let me just throw that out and see if those of you that had a chance to review it, are there other suggestions you would make that at the staff level we could do prior to next meeting to help, you know, at least frame the issue for the discussion, because we want to get into a real meaty discussion of role next time, so that we're in a position prior to going out to the public in our stakeholder meetings to be able to discuss with them, you know, our tentative concepts about mission, vision, and role as we proceed. So next session I see as a very substantive discussion, but what I'm asking here is this a helpful document to helping you think through the kind of discussion you want to have, or would you like to see some modifications to it? Mary?
No, I think it's really helpful, and it's a, you know, you can kind of go through and pick and see where you would be comfortable. I would ask that you guys articulate convener, only because this is a regional body that where success in achieving our vision, I don't think it can happen if we're not at least thinking about that convener role. I'm not saying that's where we should land, but I think to articulate what that would be in these areas would be a helpful thing to add for us.
We could do that for sure. More
along the same lines. I think we need to think about the other actors and how they fit into this matrix. If we're going to be the leader, whom are we leading? What do they bring? If we're going to simply operate, who's giving that vision? And what's the framework in which our activities merge with the others who have key roles to play?
Specific, primarily the jurisdictions. Right.
Well, I'd say stakeholder groups, really, I think. You know, so you end up with riders, you end up with non-governmentals, you end up with the jurisdictions, you end up with the state. I mean, there's a bunch of actors. Every time we talk about this, we say, we got to talk to those folks.
Okay. Kathy?
No, and I was thinking of a regional role because I think one part of the Region 4 talks about the larger planning process. And I think how we engage the jurisdictions and where their role will be in this, such that we're coming together in terms of how the decision-making process will work. I think we can be conveners in the aspect of the transit aspect, but what role do we become as a push and pull in the development aspect of what we do in the areas?
For example, the H&T index, again, I mean,
exactly
your point, I mean, If you focus on getting that H&T index below 45% in everything you do, then that leads to a whole bunch of stuff that John and Alan were talking about as an example. Any other thoughts here? Are we good then on the plan for next time? With the modifications outlined?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Okay, I think the directions here.